Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 1st of June. Our main stories: protesters defy curfews across the US as anger intensifies over the death of the African-American man George Floyd. Police in Hong Kong ban a vigil to mark the Tiananmen Square massacre. And warnings from Iran about a dangerous new peak in coronavirus cases as the country records its highest number of infections in 2 months. Also in this podcast, the art galleries opening up in Europe.
Once you're in the museum, you are able to roam free. We wanted to make the experience of the museum as normal as possible.
What a lack of water means for the battle against COVID-19 in South Africa. And we hear from Kenya, where flooding is adding to the woes of coronavirus and swarming locusts.
Kenya is a resilient nation, but never in the history of a nation has our resilience been tested to this extent.
From New York in the east to Los Angeles in the west, unrest over the death in police custody of an unarmed black man has now spread to 75 cities across the United States. At one point on Friday, protests outside the White House prompted the Secret Service to take President Trump to an emergency bunker. George Floyd died a week ago after being arrested outside a shop in Minneapolis. A white policeman, Derek Chauvin, has been charged with his murder. Three other officers have been sacked. But that hasn't reduced the anger, as Barbara Platusha reports from the city.
I can't breathe. The chant of a new generation of African Americans, raised in a country stifled by racial disparity and the toxic politics of a divided nation.
This is a war.
May was a month of grim milestones for the United States. A staggering number of coronavirus deaths and unprecedented unemployment.
First thing we're going to do is have a quick moment of silence for the guy that just lost his life right here, and George Floyd, and then we're going to move.
And then came the death of George Floyd, the black man arrested for trying to use a fake $20 bill. A white police officer pressed his knee into Mr. Floyd's neck and kept it there for more than 8 minutes as he cried out that he couldn't breathe. Now, police violence and racial discontent have been injected into an already incendiary mix. The scale of destruction caused by nights of fiery protest shocked Minneapolis. Most demonstrators here do not support that kind of violence, but they see this as a pivotal moment in the long struggle for racial justice.
This is not just because of George Floyd. This is because of all the black lives that have been murdered by the police, and not just by the policemen, but by racist white people who roam the streets and kill us. They think they have a right to police us.
There have been a lot of protests before, haven't there? Do you think these are any different? Will anything change?
Absolutely. What do we got to lose? There's a point of being policed where we just reach our wit's end, and this is our wit's end.
No peace! No peace!
The curfew hour of 8 o'clock has come, but despite that, these protesters have marched down a main street with cars behind them honking in support, and they've stopped in front of the police station that was burned out late last week.
This has gone too far for them to just ignore. It's not going to be something that they can just sweep under the rug, because if it happens again, we're going to see more stuff like this, unfortunately.
So you think the violence, even though you don't support it, serves a certain purpose?
It does. Like Martin Luther King Jr. says, the riots are the language of the unheard.
And what's the solution?
Justice. People need to be held accountable for their actions.
The city's black police chief, Madira Arredondo, is also looking for justice.
In my mind, this was a violation of humanity. This was a violation of the oath that the majority of the men and women that put this uniform on, this goes absolutely against it. This is contrary to what we believe in.
Chief Arredondo has been speaking the language of reconciliation, going out on the streets of Minneapolis to meet protesters. And in this interview with CNN, he removed his hat and spoke directly to the Floyd family.
I would say to the Floyd family that I'm absolutely devastatingly sorry for their loss. And if I could do anything to bring Mr. Floyd back, I would move heaven and earth to do that. So I'm very sorry.
Minneapolis Police Chief Medaria Arredondo ending that report by Barbara Plett-Usher. On the 4th of June in 1989, Chinese troops violently broke up pro-democracy demonstrations around Tiananmen Square in Beijing. Hundreds, possibly thousands of people were killed. Now, for the first time in 30 years, there will be no public gathering in Hong Kong to remember those who died. The police in the territory have refused permission for the annual candlelit vigil, adding to fears that the communist authorities in Beijing are trying to remove the freedoms previously enjoyed in Hong Kong. So what did the police in the territory say? I asked our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
Officially, they're citing concerns over the spread, potential spread of the coronavirus, the virus restrictions that are currently in place that actually expire the day after June 4th, which is when the vigil would have taken place. Those restrictions limit gatherings to people, to groups of eight people or less. So that's the police's official explanation. But frankly, this ban on this huge Tiananmen commemoration really doesn't come after come as a surprise. It comes after a year of rising tensions and anger between the Hong Kong authorities and many citizens in Hong Kong who really see that Beijing is trying to assert its power over the territory. And in recent months, Beijing's really taken off the gloves. It's really moved to impose and speak out much more against what's going on in Hong Kong. Just recently, it's imposed a new national security law over the people of Hong Kong. That is set out to target terrorism and subversion. But many people believe that would really just close the existing space for political expression in Hong Kong.
I mean, I was always surprised that any event marking Tiananmen Square was allowed anywhere in China, given that the communist authorities tried to clamp down on it. And I guess that just highlights the special status of Hong Kong.
Well, yeah, the once special status, definitely. I mean, the basic law that was put into place, the mini constitution that was put into place when Hong Kong was handed back from the British back to China, that law enshrined certain political freedoms. And people in Hong Kong really held those freedoms tightly. And so that's why every year this mass vigil became bigger and bigger. Last year, 100,000 people attended the vigil to mark what happened on June 4th in Beijing. And that's what's really important about it. It was the only place in China where large groups of people could gather together and remember what happened.
Celia Hatton. Iran has announced its highest number of new coronavirus infections for 2 months. The Iranian health minister has warned there could be a dangerous new peak at any moment. Here's our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
The latest official figures from Iran show almost 3,000 new coronavirus infections in the past 24 hours, with 81 more deaths. The health minister, Saeed Namaki, has said it's clear that the crisis is far from over. Since early April, Iran has been trying as much as it can to reopen businesses, schools and mosques after suffering the worst outbreak in the Middle East. Officially, it's recorded nearly 7,900 deaths, but other accounts have put the figure much higher. Officials have been warning for the past 2 weeks of a resurgence in several provinces. They've blamed people for not following preventive measures. Mr. Namaki said the authorities had pleaded with people not to hold weddings or funerals, but they hadn't listened.
Sebastian Usher. According to official figures, Russia has the third highest number of coronavirus infections in the world, more than 400,000. Moscow has been hit particularly hard, but now it's starting to lift restrictions, despite the fact that Russia saw a record number of COVID-19 deaths in the past week. Sarah Rainsford reports from Moscow.
It's been a grey and rainy first day out of lockdown, as Muscovites are allowed out for exercise at last and shops across the city opened. Face masks are now mandatory, though plenty of people take that quite loosely, stringing them around their chins. This opening up is happening with the coronavirus infection rate still stubbornly high. But officials here insist that the worst has passed, and Vladimir Putin certainly wants to move on. He's already rescheduled the 75th anniversary Victory Day parade for later this month, and he's expected to announce the date for a key vote on constitutional reforms that would allow him another 2 terms in office. It's thought the Kremlin's keen to do that before the strain on Russia's economy of COVID-19 and on Mr. Putin's approval rating really show.
Sarah Rainsford. Anyone who's been to a popular museum in peak tourist season will know how hard it is to avoid the crowds. But on Monday, two of Europe's best-known art galleries have reopened, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam and the Guggenheim in Bilbao. Both had been closed for many weeks because of the pandemic. I heard the details from our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd.
This is a big day for Europe's most important museums and galleries, in some nations, not in all. I think it's happening today partly because June is upon us already and the first happens to have fallen on a Monday, so it's a good time to make this very tricky decision. In Spain, the Guggenheim reopens today at a closure on the 14th of March, albeit for limited hours. That's one way they're limiting the risk. And in Amsterdam, the huge Rijksmuseum opens today. It's having normal hours, but it's opening only by pre-booking a ticket only, and there will be just 2,000 visitors allowed every day. That's crucial compared to around 11 or 12,000 normally. The director there, Taco Dibitz, told me about the new arrangements.
You can only buy a ticket online. There are time slots to enter the museum, and this is to create a structure in which the visitors can enter the museum safely. Once you're in the museum, you are able to roam free. It's a huge building and there's enough space for everybody. And we wanted to make the experience of the museum as normal as possible.
Well, for those going in, there'll be quite a good chance to see exhibitions without the crowds. But what else is going to reopen across Europe?
It's by no means just these two, Ollie. The Van Gogh in Amsterdam is also reopening this week. In Rome, the Vatican museums have also opened today. It's the same story everywhere, I think, of pre-booked tickets only, although art museums and galleries have been going in that direction anyway. And in fact, that will be the case in almost all of these galleries, I think. In Paris, perhaps the best-known art museum anywhere in the world, the Louvre, is scheduled to open on July the 6th. I'm not going to go through every one of these, but the Musée d'Orsay is to open at the end of the month. So this is really picking up speed now. As yet, nothing here in the UK, but places like the British Museum and the Tate Museums will be looking across the channel with great interest, especially at how they impose social distancing and limit their visitor numbers.
Vincent Dowd. Still to come in the podcast. A boost for one of the world's most endangered animals. South Africa eased some of its lockdown restrictions on Monday, including allowing the sale of alcohol for the first time in 2 months, prompting big queues. The government there has urged people to continue washing their hands frequently and to observe good personal hygiene to keep COVID-19 at bay. But it's not easy in areas where water is scarce. The lack of taps and clean running water in rural parts of KwaZulu-Natal, for example, has forced people to share streams with animals, as Nomsa Maseko reports.
It's early morning in rural KwaZulu-Natal. Women are lining up with buckets, waiting for their turn to collect water. Some already arguing about who was the first to arrive and why they should be given priority. They're bracing themselves for the arrival of coronavirus. The watering hole is protected by rusted corrugated iron sheets. The women carefully make their way to this shallow hole in the ground, kneeling on a rocky patch of grass. They use jugs to fill up their 20-litre buckets. But there's very little water to go around for 400 households. Eunice Zulu is one of the villagers.
We have a massive water shortage. We have to share with cows and donkeys. There are dead crabs and frogs in there, but we use that water because we don't know what else to do. We hear on the radio they talk about this new virus, COVID-19, and the government says we must wash our hands often. But that's impossible for us. We don't have enough water to go around.
6 hours later, Eunice finally reached the front of the queue and her 20-litre bucket is full. The women here help each other to carry the buckets on their heads and take a long and uphill walk back home. At her home, another villager, Zanele Ngosi, purifies the water with bleach. She urges her children to use it sparingly, teaching them hand-washing techniques.
I'm going into the next one. The village was given 2 tanks of water at the beginning of the pandemic. But that lasts 3 days, and the tanks are only refilled every 2 to 3 weeks. Despite the odds stacked against this village, they're still proactive.
Limak has been out to their farm.
Spiwe Pthelezi is a community caregiver who educates people on COVID-19 symptoms to look out for. She started making masks. Demand is so high, she's run out of fabric. She cuts up old clothes to use instead.
We've been watching on the news the government telling us about the dangers of coronavirus, so we didn't want to be caught on the back foot. We had to start immediately to follow all regulations, because when death visits, it doesn't just stop at major towns only. Death is everywhere.
People here are doing all they can, preparing to tackle the virus if or when it arrives in their village.
Nomsa Maseko in KwaZulu-Natal. In eastern Africa, there's an entirely different problem with water at the moment. Rainy season usually ends by June, but for some in Kenya, it's already gone on far too long. Severe floods and landslides have killed nearly 300 people and displaced more than 800,000 others. The rains have also hampered efforts to control the worst plague of locusts in decades, while increasing the likely spread of COVID-19. The BBC's Mercy Juma reports from a flooded village near the banks of Lake Naivasha in Kenya.
I have arrived at the edge of Kihoto village, about 2 hours away from Nairobi. Villagers here, many of them fishermen, say one night in early May, they woke up to find the lake's waters flooding their crop fields and flowing into their houses. Hundreds of families had to abandon their homes to find shelter. Water levels continue to rise. The Water Resource Authority says the lake is now almost 2,000 meters above sea level, the highest it's been since the 1970s. Bicycles, motorcycles and cars have been replaced by boats which ferry the residents who stayed behind up to their doorsteps. On a small canoe, I accompany Francis Wanjiru, his wife and their 2-year-old daughter from the main shopping centre where most shops are heavily flooded to their doorstep.
The lake is rising every day. There is corona too affecting us. We are now at a place where we can also contract cholera, typhoid and bilharzia, which we fear very much. But we do not have a place to move to.
Most people we spoke to here felt that the government had done very little to help those affected by the flooding and were focusing all resources towards managing the COVID-19 pandemic, which has caused at least 50 deaths in the country and more than 1,400 infections. Close to 500,000 people in Western Kenya are now homeless from the floods and ensuing landslides. Houses, livestock and fields have been swept away and the economy is disrupted. More than half of the deaths linked to the rains are from this region. David Kiarie, a fisherman, says surviving has been tough.
First, it was COVID-19, which greatly affected our fishing business and spoiled the market because people are not coming over to buy fish. And then waters came, making things even worse.
Some of those who managed to evacuate are being housed in temporary shelters like schools, where physical distancing is nearly impossible. The government says it is struggling to relocate people while maintaining safety measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Minister Eugene Wamalwa is leading the flood response.
The problem we're having is that we have multiple disasters at the same time. And may I say, Kenya is a resilient nation. But never in the history of a nation has our resilience been tested to this extent.
Meanwhile, the country's meteorological department has warned that heavy rains are expected to continue until early June.
Mercy Juma reporting from Kenya. Now to an incredible sound which has been in danger of disappearing for good. Well, that is the call of one of the world's rarest animals, the Hainan gibbon, recorded by a conservation project, the Kadoorie Farm and Botanic Garden in Hong Kong. Now there is a glimmer of hope for the creatures, which live only in a small area on China's Hainan Island. After decades of decline from poaching and deforestation, a breeding pair has now been discovered. I heard more from our environment correspondent, Helen Briggs.
They're known for their acrobatic skills in the trees and also for their haunting songs. And this Hainan gibbon has the rather dubious accolade of being the rarest ape, the rarest primate and possibly the rarest mammal. And it now lives only in one place, in a small fragment of forest. They're very cute animals. The males and females are completely different in appearance. The males have black fur and the females have this golden fur, and they bond for life and form these social groups, and they sing together at dawn. So incredible creatures.
Now, at one point, there were fewer than 10 of them left alive. They have recovered slightly, but tell us about this new breeding pair that have been discovered.
Well, yes, we had 2,000 of them back in the 1950s, but numbers have been in catastrophic decline because of deforestation. They've been losing their habitat, and also they've been hunted for food and traditional medicine. So they got down to incredibly low numbers, just 13 in two social groups, all living in this tiny area of forest. Then late last year, they heard the songs of the gibbon. So you don't normally see them, but you hear them with these incredible songs. And then they were surprised because it was out of this fragment of forest where the main population is found. So subsequently, they went back and listened to them and observed them, and they found that they were a male and a female, and they can tell from their songs that they formed a breeding pair, that they've bonded. So this is the fifth breeding pair. So the hope is that they have offspring, or they'll go on and have offspring and try and increase numbers. But they're still very, very fragile recovery, a tiny population, only about 30 of them. So still very fragile, but some hope that conservation efforts can pay off.
Yeah, it's taken a long time to get them up to even that level. And I know that a number of other species of gibbon recently disappeared in China. So are there lessons to learn here?
Well, I think what they've said to me is that this shows that if you put in decades of conservation work, that it can pay off. Every different ape, and there are many facing a perilous future, has a different story, but it does offer some hope. What they did in this case is they started doing proper surveys about 20 years ago to actually work out exactly how many of them were left. They were doing patrols and monitoring and then research work, so studying the apes' behaviour and their ecology. Then importantly, trying to give them habitat, give them shelter and give them food. Now, these apes, they largely eat fruit and leaves, so they've been planting trees that the apes like to eat. So this does seem to be paying off to some extent. But of course, with anything like deforestation, then it's a huge uphill battle to try and get the forests regenerated to be able to support these animals again. But Philip Lowe, who did the conservation work for the Hainan Gibbon Conservation Project, said to me, "I can't imagine how sad it would be if the rainforest lost this beautiful animal and its wonderful song."
Helen Briggs. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
All passengers for Palestine, this way!
Miriam.
I am a Jewish woman. I have no homeland other than this. My mother and I fled fire and hatred, came here and met it again.
And Yusuf.
When I was a boy, there was nothing between here and Al-Quds, Jerusalem. But there was never a question that this was our homeland.
A podcast drama from the BBC World Service.
There's a cycle here. Disturbances, bloodshed. It's vital we don't overreact.
Telling the story of the founding of Israel.
500,000 Arabs under Jewish rule and 10,000 Jews under the Arabs. How will that work? How can we split this tiny land?
Miriam and Yusuf. Search for Miriam and Yusuf. That's M-I-R-I-A-M and Y-O-U-S-S-E-F wherever you get your podcasts.